An Australia without rugby league is not Australia. Rugby league has been a fabric of our society for hundreds of years. It's people's escape, it's people's relaxation, and we need to do everything in order to continue that great tradition of rugby league.
It has been those Australians who have worked hard every day. They have their dreams, they have their aspirations. These are the quiet Australians who have won a great victory tonight.
Well, boys, I hate to disagree, but 21 years ago, it wasn't a great victory. 1999, the christening of the brand new stadium out at Homebush pre-Olympics with St George and Melbourne, of course, and St George.
Disaster.
Bundled out. Now, our special guest today, Dennis Carnahan, Chris Gayle, good afternoon. Ignatius Jones is our special guest today. Talk about, on this very day, 20 years ago, was the opening night ceremony of the Sydney Olympics 2000 AD.
Was it ever.
So we're here to talk about that today. Though the venue was built for the Olympics, it was used for that one big event, the grand final, before the Olympics. And then I think you had to squeeze out during the Olympics at some point for rehearsals because of the rugby league again. Is that true?
Yeah, we had to go to Schofields, which was about 3 miles south of Bumfuck.
Right. So we might say that the Olympics are the biggest game on the planet, but really rugby league can push the Olympics out the door for a few years.
Indeed they can.
Politis.
Yes. Now, there's a few things I want to touch upon here. There was a number of segments in the opening. Rick Birch was the executive producer. Correct me if I'm wrong on all this.
Rick Birch was the director of ceremonies.
Ceremonies, okay.
Yeah, there's a whole sort of Olympic hierarchy, you know, with titles and stuff, kind of like the royal family.
So how are you like, you know, if you're Prince Charles, what is David Atkins?
Prince Philip.
Andrew? No. Prince Philip. For those who don't know, David Atkins, he was a dancer. He was in Squizzy Taylor, choreographer and event producer that you worked with many, many times.
Yeah. I worked with David for 12 years, and I actually met him through the Olympics. Until then, he was kind of, Australia's lead producer and director in a certain world.
Musicals? No,
Sort of. Put it this way, he has 14 Mo Awards.
Right, okay.
Is that like facial sculptures? So he's a master of
Is that for comedy? But given that this thing happened 20 years ago today. Just a bit of backstory about how you got involved and how long did it take before you actually got to this day?
Gosh. As you know, I was in popular music with you.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry, Stephen was in popular music, Ignatius, was he? We've never heard anything about this.
You know, we're just about to make our first Wikipedia page.
I'd started off ridiculously enough as a classical ballet dancer and an opera singer. And while I was training for this, I broke my toe.
To the first of many.
The first bone I broke.
Of many, yeah.
And I haven't stopped since. But while I was off, you know, I mean, from the ballet school, my brother had a rock and roll band.
That's right.
He said to me, you know, all this shit and you can dance. Yeah. But I didn't. I had to learn.
This is Louis.
Yeah, this is Louis.
I remember seeing them at a venue on the Pacific Highway at St. Leonard's downstairs. I don't even know what the venue was called then. Nothing salubrious, I'm sure. Probably a wine bar.
Pickled Parrot or something.
Stop me if
like
I digress too much.
The train station.
Anyway, so I ended up in this band. It was cool. Well, I don't know what it was called, but I said, nah, I want to call it Gamora. And they should have known what was coming. Oh, and I had much longer hair than I do now. And, you know, this was 1974.
So it's pre-Jimmy and the Boys.
Oh, yeah, pre-Jimmy and the Boys. You know, and I had the huge high heels. Everything was black. cast iron jewelry, black fingernails. It was long. I looked like Lou Reed's mother. And my mates, you know, I'd been at Riverview and left.
There's been a few wayward types, hasn't it?
Indeed. Well, one of my, William O'Riordan, who was in the year before me, he had moved to Cranbrook, where he joined this really fey jazz rock band.
There's nothing wrong with fusion.
I think they were called Stamps.
You know, and a Z and you're away.
Yeah. Anyway, I became really good mates with them. And when they heard that I was performing, I think it was at the Lane Cove High Prom. Anyway, they all turned up to see it. And somehow they must have been on drugs. They, at the end of the show, they went, "Oh, you've got to join Jimmy and the Boys." I went, "Really?" Anyway, the next year was 1976, and it was, you know, punk rock. And I said, "Guys, nah, it doesn't work. You got to cut all your hair. You know, you've got to get rid of those bell bottoms. You've got to start wearing leather."
And you saw Jimmy and the Boys, Chris?
I don't reckon I ever saw you guys live, because at that point of time, I was about 14, 15 and not quite going out. But I do have a very, very clear memory of you guys being on John Singleton's talk show. Do you remember that?
Yeah. And he started commenting on my skin.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, he was – and, I mean, we're looking for a rugby league connection all the time, aren't we, yeah, Stephen? Because the main reason we're not covering rugby league today is because the Dragons and the Tigers are out.
But and that pushes Dennis into a convenient corner.
Yep, yep.
But Singo, I think at one stage – asked you guys about the fact that you simulated cunnilingus on stage. And as a young teenager, that was terrific television for me. And I was interested.
So you didn't have to go to the dictionary?
No.
It was really interesting. You know, I suppose we were the first out-of-it gay act in Australian history, especially in the rock and roll world. And none of our fans were gay. They were all these sort of, you know.
As I said, I don't think we used to think about that.
No, you didn't.
Away you go.
They would, you know, you'd have all these surfies with their shirts off at the front of the band going, 16, 9, 16. And I'd go, yeah, wait for it.
But this was like pre-Pistols, really, wasn't it? I mean, you
same time.
So you were responding to that?
You put your finger in the wind, surely.
Sorry?
You put your finger to the wind and thought, okay, where are we going?
Oh, it was happening. If you think about what was happening in Australia at the time, it was sherbet. Yeah. And, you know, yeah.
But at the same time, for example, I remember maybe a little bit after, but the Paris Theatre was putting on wild performances of all sorts, including punk rock, you know. Yeah. There was little bars like Blondie's at Bondi Junction, and I remember X used to play up at the Unicorn. There were, the Hopeton, there were pubs doing their business.
Across the road at the what became Gilligan's.
That's right. Yeah, the Auction. Yeah.
And there was that formative moment where on ABC used to have Weekend Magazine on the Channel 2 News, and they did a piece on the Sex Pistols.
Right.
And I reckon that's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I got into music because I saw Bowie put his arm around Mark Ronson on Top of the Pops. Nicholson. I reckon for a lot of Australian musicians, that little piece must have just changed.
Well, you and Countdown were friends, of course.
Sorry?
You and Countdown,
you're
in lockstep for many years.
For many. Well, I used to do this rave. You know, it was part of the show. I mean, people who thought that Jimmy and the Boys was real, you know, it's a little bit like thinking a magician is real. You know, I'm a trained ballet dancer.
We'd
planned it all, you know, and journalists would always say after an interview, "Oh my God, you're so civilized. I thought you were going to throw up on me." You know, and I go, "Yeah, you know."
You can do that too.
Yeah, I can do that too. I did a couple of times, it was all highly planned, and I had this rave during the act about Molly, you know, which just went on and on, and you know, it would build.
Did you know Molly at that point?
No.
No, okay.
Right, so I didn't know fishing. Molly. I hadn't met Molly yet. And then one night at Bombay Rock, which was kind of like Melbourne's version of The Lifesaver.
Yes, yes.
I was in the middle of the Molly rave, and the people down the front were going, "He's behind you."
So you're going to pantomime now.
And he was. Anyway, he...
But you could say that he took you not under his wing, but you were part of his circus.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. He loved it. He'd never had so much attention.
Yeah. I mean, any man that can go, let's get let Iggy Pop go nuts.
Yeah.
As well as John Paul Young do whatever he wants to do, and you, good luck to us.
Yeah, he wasn't, he's a clever man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Clever man. And as you say, we became part of the Molly, we sobered Iggy Pop and John Paul Young. Go figure.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember one night we were at Molly's house, and he loved to do dinner parties, right? And he'd have the current boyfriends and the Iggy Pops and the John Paul Youngs and sitting around the table. And most of the time, the little boyfriends would be shunted out of the room. And this particular time, they'd gone out the back where the swimming pool was. Yes. And they also had one of the first, what do you call them,
spa?
Yeah, bath things.
That
bubbled, what are they?
Jacuzzi.
In an Egyptian theme, I'm assuming. Yeah.
With an Egyptian theme, and they pour tons of Luxor brand bubble bath. I think they've taken his entire stock, and they filled the what are they called?
Hot tub.
Yeah. With lots of bubble. And anyway, we're sitting there having dinner, and it's all these glass doors going out to the pool. And suddenly we saw this wave of bubbles
coming to the house,
which was about 12 feet high, moving across the pool. Molly
and then
freaked.
What happened?
That was the opening ceremony, wasn't it? I think I remember that scene. In the deep sea section.
If I could, because we've got an hour here, Ignatius. We go from your music career, which of course, there was your big band's
never
period,
missed. Yeah.
Arms and Legs, which is a sort of proto sort of futuristic funk band like Talking Heads or whatever. Many other things, but somehow you moved into events. What was that sort of switch over into events?
Well, pardon me, boys. Yeah. Another 12 years later or something. Was a swing band.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, we went out.
And every time you say that, do you want to sing? You don't. Pardon me, boy.
Please, Stephen. It's out of Pathagonian toothfish, So in 92, the Sydney Festival asked us to do something with that and create a 1940s dance hall.
Right.
A sort of Trocadero Sydney Town Hall.
That's right, yeah.
And I was on stage and, arranging the music and working on the choreography, So I said, I want to get a director.
Yeah.
Who can actually direct.
Oh, you want a director not to get a director's fee?
No, I wanted a director as well.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And I found this young guy called Baz Luhrmann, who,
never went on to do anything.
He was right into it.
Fresh out of NIDA.
He was still in NIDA.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Still in NIDA. Yeah. And Jimmy Sharman, whom I'd known from the Paris Theatre days, said,
he used to live up the road from me in Victoria Street many years ago.
Really? Mm. Yeah. Mm. Love Jimmy.
Mm.
Anyway, Jimmy said, "I've got this fabulous young guy. You'll like him." And we did. We got on like a house on fire, and CM was... Fresher Martin, we used to call
Martin,
her.
Sorry.
Because she did look like a young schoolboy or a 13-year-old lesbian, take your pick. Anyway, it went really well and it ran for 3 or 4 years. And during that, I was running running a big band. We got the Olympics. Rick Birch came. Rick Birch was a producer, director, and his first big hit was Bellbird.
Oh, yeah.
Was he involved with GTK?
No. No, okay. No, no. Molly.
Okay.
And a number of people.
Yes, but okay.
Rick said, yeah, it'll
so
be
did you know
them.
Rick?
No.
No, so how did you then get involved with
that? So Rick was part of the bid team, the Olympic bid team, and he had directed the 1982 Com Games in Brisbane, the opening of that, you know, with the
Matilda.
Matilda the blinking cockatoo, who lost her load, literally. she came in to the stadium, there was Prince Philip, and she very lasciviously winked at Chris Philip. And at the very same time...
Who was in charge of the winking?
Could have been. At the very same time, she burst an oil tank. And this huge black slick emerged between her legs. All through
I didn't see that on the camera.
The influence of Prince
Philip.
Is this
on YouTube? This should be on YouTube.
It probably is.
It needs to be.
And
it.
I think Rick Burchie was involved in some of like Los Angeles as well, wasn't he?
So what happened in Los Angeles was they'd hired Disney to do their opening ceremony. And anyway, what was his name? He became the mayor of Los Angeles.
Schwarzenegger? No, he was the governor. Who was the mayor? That's right.
Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah. He wasn't the mayor at the time. Anyway. Yeah. He had a fight with Disney. They wanted to Mickey Mouse the whole Olympic ceremony. He said, you can't do that. and so they had no creatives. And funnily enough, an Australian fireworks guy, Sid Howard, whom they'd hired, said, oh, you should have a look at this Rick guy. He did a great job with Brisbane. So over Rick goes. He wasn't actually the director. He was the production manager. Right. But he still helped facilitate stuff like the 84 grand pianos and the,
where was
you know,
the
Rocket
with
Man.
Barcelona.
That's Barcelona.
Yeah.
Which Rick also did.
Right, okay. Right.
The closing ceremony of Los Angeles in 84 is the guy in the jetpack.
No, that's opening.
Oh, it's opening as well, right?
Yeah, it's opening.
Which was replicated on the 1991 Dangerous Tour with Michael Jackson.
Yes.
And so at the end of the show, they do this magic trick, or they put a box around him, and out would emerge the Rocket Man, and theoretically it was Jackson zooming off into the distance, right? And in the History Tour, which was 96, you got this video on rails, and it's flying towards your city, and out of the floor pops Michael Jackson in the same suit 5 years later.
Just like that.
Unbelievable.
He was in the ether, lost.
Incredible.
wasn't there a grand final that had someone on a jetpack?
I think that's right.
The NRL, but it would have been well before 91. And this would have been in the 80s.
Well,
it was like at 80, 81.
Rugby league is a proving ground for big global events.
Exactly. You know, they're all watching.
42nd Street didn't work out, but you know.
Dennis and I, in our very small way, we work out of that same institution, you know, the Homebush Olympic Stadium.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's trying to find ways all the time of what can we do with this stadium to make it, you know.
Burn it.
Exactly. Knock it down.
Let's have a break and we'll come back in a minute. We're going to talk about the opening ceremony, 2000 Sydney Olympics, 20 years today, the 15th of September with Ignatius Jones, Dennis Carnahan, Chris Gayle, myself. We're back. Dennis Carnahan, how you doing? You must be feeling pretty damn good since your team beat my team last weekend. In actual fact, your team didn't beat my team. My team just collapsed. They were bloody hopeless. I think that
it was.
I'm
not going to get a word in, am I?
You don't announce with 3 weeks to go the leaving of all the support staff of a team and hope to get a good result. It's not a good idea. I don't know who thought that was a great idea.
Have you finished?
Yes, I have.
Ricky's word is ambush. Preparing a finals ambush from fifth
Good
place.
Luck to you.
And you people don't know what goes on in this jersey.
Oh,
oh God, I love Ricky.
Yeah.
Uncharted territories. What about Papali signed on? I thought he was unhappy and lost, and now he's green, bleeding green.
Well, it was, funnily enough, it was all Brisbane media saying that. All the stories about Papali wanting to leave. And also, you know, Tommy Starling, your boy Tommy Starling,
love
who
Tommy
waved
Starling.
At you.
Yeah.
he's signed on as well. See you, Soliola.
Come on, what about Cody Ramsey?
Cody Ramsey.
First game. Two tries, should have been three.
Well, he came on ABC Grandstand immediately after the game. We had the first interview with him.
You know he's not really quite there because he's still got the ponytail.
Well, he has, but you know what the first word he said after his debut, two tries, you know what the first word he said was? Michael Luck.
Well, that third try that was called back, they got the isolation camera on his mother.
And she was saying,
at the top of her lungs, Michael yelled, Michael Luck off.
So the question is his dad, in fact, Gordon Ramsay?
Yes.
That was posited on one of the footy shows. Yeah.
You got the good genes then.
Stephen, we're so lucky to have Ignatius with us. I don't want to take up too much time, but I do simply want to say.
Oh, yes.
Ignatius is a Raiders fan.
How could you not be?
Love that look.
The Lost Ark.
As you know, Doughboy Pizza has come on as a sponsor of Fire Ups Quite Australia.
And I had no idea their history matched the Olympics.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Because 20 years ago, some young men with a dream.
It was triggered by the Olympics, was it?
And their dream was crispy, fresh and artisanal.
Oh.
Now, I had a dream like that last night, but it was in a different context to pizza. Anyway, they also applied.
I don't recall pizzas being at the opening ceremony, but I'm sure they were stuck in there somewhere.
Well, they only just opened.
Yeah, they were formulating a way that Doughboy Pizza began 20 years ago.
Right.
And they are a sponsor of Fire Ups Quite Australia.
Yeah.
Now, this is spooky. 20 years ago, the Sydney Olympics opening ceremony, basically Ignatius Jones single-handedly pulls it off.
Mm-hmm.
The Doughboy boys change pizza in Sydney, well, particularly South, North, Bondi, Artarmon and Randwick forever.
Right.
20 years.
And they're offering a discount on their wonderful pizzas,
yes.
Thin and crispy.
Anybody who's listening.
Spelt or gluten-free, simply by entering the code FIREUP, F-I-R-E-U-P, caps or no caps, and have a guess how much off you get if you enter that.
15.
10%.
20%.
20%.
Isn't
20
that
years,
spooky?
20 years, 20%.
Yep.
Do they have a...
20 years, 20%.
Do they have a pizza called the Sergeant Pepper?
they're working on that, Dennis. And so if you want to, like we are, wade in nostalgia because there'll be endless shows for the next 2 weeks.
They've got one called Nicky Webster, right?
100%. They've got a Webster.
Well, we've got Sergeant Pepper here.
Get the Doughboy pizza and you'll enjoy yourselves.
We've got Sergeant Pepper right here.
Absolutely.
It was on the day.
All right, Ignatius, we're going to have another segment. We're going to talk about your music career. We're going to talk about the opening night of the Olympics. But what I want to know, first of all, is were there internally, because I remember walking into your office where you worked with Rick Birch and David Atkins, everybody else, because you drafted my brother and I to help you with the fireworks music in 1999. And then my brother Pee Wee, I think, went on to do the other one after that. There obviously was a robust discussions for years about what themes you would use. And obviously Australia presented to the world is... The premise, I suppose, and there are various segments. There's the immigrants, you know, the man from Snowy River, the rural history, the indigenous section with Rhoda Roberts and Stephen Page, many others. What did you drop out? What was the fight like to get that organised? That theme.
Look, the main thing there was that Rick did have a one very good idea, which was. Rather than to make it the work of a single person, to bring nine directors on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And stick them in a room. And did a really interesting thing. He'd managed to get all these clips from the different Olympics for the last, I think he went all the way back to Montreal and just showed what they had done. And it was quite interesting because Montreal did bugger all, and did a little bit of folk dancing and
76
leg
Montreal?
Slapping.
Yep, right. 76.
76.
Yeah. 70. Canada didn't win any gold medals. Not one. Nada. That's
72, they didn't really want to remember.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless you wanted to remember the Palestinians.
Was there an overlay of what do, particularly Americans, what do people overseas know of Australia?
We kind of wanted to sort of leave that out.
Okay.
Because, you know, as I said later, the Sydney Olympics owed a lot more to Oxford Street than they did to Anzac Parade.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something we really wanted to do, was to get that whole get that whole, you know, drives a bone.
A Cobra.
A Cobra slouch hat. Yes. Horses. We wanted to get it, you know.
Get it done and out.
Get it out. And sure enough, that's why they gave it to the gay Spaniard.
The man from Snowy River.
The man from Snowy River. And, you know, I had to fight for the man from Snowy River. Right. And I said, you know, come on, we've only got one national poem. And that's it. And you know what? It's not a bad poem. But we had all politically correct people going, no, 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 you can't do that. And we had the indigenous people saying, oh, horses trampled our heritage.
Of course. And, you know, so there was conflict.
Look, there was conflict everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was political, wasn't it? Because I think that the first opening ceremony that had anything to it was Moscow.
And,
And the Russians, because of the boycotts.
Because of the boycott. And, that's absolutely correct.
And the key moment, a little bit like Matilda winking, which was a bit of a lift at the end, they had all the panels up of Mishka the bear, and they were able to make the bear cry by flipping the panels.
The heart of Russia.
Soviet organization. That's meticulous.
That's called a card stunt.
Thank you very much.
Right? And the card stunt has become a really important part of Olympic ceremonies, and I have always just waited in hope that someone would get it wrong. And sure enough, when we were doing the Doha Asian Games in 2006, David Atkins, David and I were working on it, and David had to go on the radio to talk about all the great things that were going to be in the opening ceremony.
Is that because you're more of a wild card than David? When it comes to front in the press?
Oh, no, I'm pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah. Okay, you are pretty
good. He was really tired.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he said, and we'll have lots of starred.
we say Carmichael Hunts. Yeah. How we say.
Exactly. And he came off that one.
Wow.
Did anyone hear me? I said, yeah, all of the Middle East.
So you did do the horses, the Akubras.
Yeah, that was a great I did. It was a truly great moment with the horses. The whole idea with the horses, I've been working in Dollywood. That's my first foray into major events was choreographing and directing the shows at Dollywood, Dolly Parton's Rodeo Theatre in Tennessee, South Carolina,
that's a great kickoff.
Missouri.
Great
debut. See if you can get through that.
So that was in the 90s?
That was in the 90s.
Right, because I don't know if you heard
Dolly Parton.
Yeah, no, I wasn't. But have you heard Dolly Parton's America? The multi-part podcast they've just made?
No.
The guy who does Radio Lab.
Right.
His father, his Iranian background from memory, and his father treated a close member of Dolly's family in Tennessee, and they came together and they'd done a whole exploration of Dolly. And one of the things that's happened in Dollywood is they've actually taken away all the Southern iconography, like the Union flag and all that. She just recently removed
the Confederate flag.
Because previously the audience, and you'd know this, was divided into the North and the South. As part of the theatre restaurant experience,
That's what the theatre restaurant experience was. And I was
I do declare.
No, and you came in, and depending on which side of the room you sat on, you were the North or you were the South. And tonight we're going to refight Civil War. And you actually had people stand up and go, I'm not going to be the North. And of course, the MC was on a horse. He would say, but we're all brothers now.
That podcast is amazing because she's fully cooperative and participates in it. Yeah. And she's used to write and record the songs on audio cassettes. And she wasn't fastidious about the cataloging of them. Mm. And on one of the audio cassettes is Jolene and I Will Always Love You. And she says, I can't guarantee this, but it's possible I wrote those two songs on the same night.
Don't say that.
That's what she says.
That's what they used to do, right?
Yeah.
Dennis, you know that.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I was actually brought there originally because Rick Birch was, he'd created the first show, and during it he discovered that he was utterly allergic to horses.
In your coming nations?
Well, I'd just done the opening of Crown Casino for him.
Yeah.
And after it, I said, that was great work. Tell me something. what do you know about country music?
You know most things about most music, right?
Well, yeah, but country music was a complete blank. I said, well, no, I can learn. And he said, what do you know about horses? And I said, nothing. He said, good. And I was off to Tennessee.
Wow.
And the issue they had was they had a Christmas show, which ran for about 3 weeks. And it was set in the Civil War. And it wasn't working. I said, well, why, you know, why don't we do something more Christmassy, you know, like the Nutcracker? And I was sitting at this table with the board of Dollywood, and they went, Nutcracker.
You, tell
and
me
I said,
again.
It's, yeah, it's a lot like The Little Drummer Boy. And they went, oh, Little Drummer Boy, Dolly sings that.
You must have also had to keep your tongue many times at many meetings. The stuff you may have heard from clients, for example.
Oh, my God.
I'm not looking for an example, but anyway.
That's another great story.
The Man from Snowy River.
The Man from Snowy River. So the whole idea about this was that five lines of 20 horses would come out, you know, in a straight.
Regimental sort
of. Yeah, in a line. Yeah. And to do that, they had to come through the VOMs.
Yes.
All for some gorgeous reason, all entrances and exits to a stadium are called vomitoriums.
Yeah, right.
I suppose because they vomit people into yeah. Anyway, so we had it worked out that you know, a certain number could come in from the two side VOMs and a certain number could come in from the end VOM.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks before the opening ceremony, they decided to put an air conditioning duct right across the end bomb, which meant that the riders coming in with their flags, you know, they had to couch them like lances. And even though they had poles on the end, if someone had stopped, they would have got this flag up their rear.
Yeah.
So they had to enter walking, which was really interrupting our... Look, I suggested, well, why don't we pull focus to the forming of lines by bringing in a sole rider, no flag, he can gallop straight through, he gets to the middle, we've got a spotlight on him.
Rears the horse up
and cracks his whip. And of course, that was not a real whip crack.
Don't tell me the timing was automatic, a button.
Yeah, we flew it in.
Shh, stop it, Stephen.
But the two great things about that horse, we had to find a horse that reared. Now, horses don't like to rear. Oh. They only rear if they see a snake.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we went everywhere around Australia trying to find a horse that reared.
Does that mean also you have to find a rider who can ride a rearing horse when a rearing horse only rears in panic?
Exactly. And, I mean, you know, the best one was when we went to El Caballo Blanco. Do you remember?
I would have thought that was just a given.
The first one you go to.
We found a horse that reared. But that was a Spanish riding school horse, and that horse was so gay. You know, he practically wore mascara. And I was going, no. That's not Outback Australia.
It needs to be more butch.
Yeah, well, we hadn't done Priscilla yet. Anyway, the about a week before the opening, our head horse whisperer, Steve Jeffries, gives me a call and says, mate, you won't believe this. I got a horse of my rears. And I said, really? He said, yeah, they brought me, because he was the whisperer. You know, they brought him to me for me to fix him. Mm. I bought him. And sure enough, Steve made a fortune from that horse because his name was Ammo, because his father's name was The Gun and he was the son of The Gun.
Gotcha.
But he was perfect.
Right. Meanwhile, you could get all the other horses in quietly in the dark.
We got all the other horses.
We have whisperers in rugby league too. the Man from Snowy River was narrated?
No, he didn't.
It was just the concept of it. Because John Stanton was the narrator, right?
Sorry?
John Stanton was the narrator.
John Stanton was the narrator.
His voice was good, wasn't it?
Oh, I love John Stanton. He played Malcolm Fraser in The Dismissal.
Yeah, that's right.
Fantastic.
John Stanton could read the Melbourne Telephone.
100%. Love that guy.
That's an interesting choice because I was listening going, what a great voice. It was very BBC nearly, you know. Then, of course, the anthem, Human Nature, Julie Anthony.
Yeah, that was the Human Nature, who were... good mates of mine.
Yes. You know,
from the business. They they ambushed me in the,
just...
in the dressing rooms at Mike Walsh.
Right.
And they said, stop. And, you know, we were...
They knew you had the job.
They knew I had the job. Okay. And we were sharing a dressing room with little Patty.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a... a bottle of Southern Comfort, which we were sharing, as you do when you have to go on.
Well, if you've been to Dollywood, it makes sense. Yeah.
You've got to go on at 10 a.m. and sing harmony.
With the Jeff Harvey Orchestra.
With the Jeff Harvey Orchestra. If she hadn't had the Southern Comfort, I know he would have. Anyway, so we're in there. We're having a ball with Patty. It's an absolute stream. And they walk in, let's do this. And they had a little pitch rock. And then they sang in stunning four-part harmony.
Yes, beautiful harmony. Yeah.
And I cried, Patty cried, and you're in. Because the Australian anthem is difficult.
It is.
Yeah. But the big deal was two verses, right?
Two verses.
Right.
Absolutely, because we had to give Julie Anthony something to do.
Right.
And her husband, whose name I can't remember, and manager, I remember in
Doug Anthony.
In the, because we actually ended up with the Human Nature, Julie Anthony, the Sydney Symphony, Simone Young, James Morrison.
That's right.
A big band. It was bigger than Ben Hur.
So Human Nature sang the first verse and then Julie came in for the second, right?
Yeah.
And then,
she's pretty pitch perfect, though, isn't she, Gnosius?
Oh,
she doesn't need a pitch pipe.
She does not.
And according to Wikipedia, so it must be true, NBC nixed the James Morrison part of the anthem because they were putting it on Plausibly Live. So they actually edited some of the stuff.
Ignatius, I was in New York City, Australian friends, a couple of Pommies, watching it. Patriotic tears. This is our city. This is fantastic. Yeah. There were many things that weren't in there.
Oh, yeah.
They cut a lot out, as far as I could tell.
In Arena, John Farnham, which was really weird because he was singing with
Olivia.
Yeah. And they knew Olivia. Yeah.
And did you see his little trick? He dropped the microphone from one hand to the other.
Yeah.
Just like a typical John Farnham, like a wink, you know?
Yeah, well, in those days, you mimed
Olympic
ceremonies.
He didn't?
He did.
At the end, they didn't. They turned the mic on.
Oh, yeah, they turned it back on, but you weren't hearing it.
Yeah, all the orchestra wasn't real. The band apparently was the one bit of live music that you heard.
The band was live.
And there was a rugby league element.
Was there?
Yeah, so the... And you wonder if they do this exactly the same...
Is how we're stringing our fans in?
you wonder if they'd actually do it exactly this way these days. But the whole European settlement, et cetera, was called the Tin Symphony.
Yeah.
And it was depicting European settlement, Captain Cook, ... But at one point, Victor Lawnmowers came out, Western Suburbs Magpies.
There you go. They were the sponsors, weren't they?
Why did the Magpies get a run? What's wrong with the Tigers?
Well, there was actually more rugby league involvement because if you look at the international organisations and the VIPs, the United Nations Secretary General, Kofi Annan, he was there. The Commonwealth of Nations Secretary General was there. One Don McKinnon.
Don McKinnon.
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming it's the same Don McKinnon.
The guy who urinated on Lane Park.
It had to be him.
And I don't want to be too nerdish about this, but your brother Pee Wee was involved in the arrival section about all the various communities coming to Australia.
Which Lex Marinos explained that he wanted to have the unifying theme of dance music because we all dance around the world, different styles.
And then the various nations were assigned one of the colours of the rings.
Yes.
Blue Pacific Nations, I can go with that. Green for Europe, sure. It starts to get a little bit interesting. Red for the Americas.
Yeah. Russia.
Yellow for Asia.
Okay.
And black for Africa. Well, it was a different time.
Well, actually, the first rings happened in 1912, the Antwerp Games, which is why that flag's called the Antwerp flag to this day.
Oh.
And it was invented by... Pierre Coubertin, the founder of the Olympics. So in 1912, having what other colour was Africa?
Exactly, right.
Yes.
I mean, the Coubertin was a good man.
The deep dark Congo.
Some of the trivia that I dug up, 199 nations out of the 200 IOC nations at the time marched, which Afghanistan was excluded because the Taliban were anti-sport, which is a legitimate argument, you know.
Yeah, he tried, it didn't work.
I'm not connecting the Taliban to FBI radio in any way, shape or form, but North and South Korea marched under a unified flag, which was an extraordinary moment. Yeah. I remember that because I was there.
Yes.
And East Timor, four East Timorese athletes marched under the Olympic flag because they weren't an accredited Olympic nation at that stage.
Right.
And then when I was looking at Fonzie and Livy did Dare to Dream, but when they brought the big sheet over the crowd in a variation of a card stunt, I guess, and they're projecting images of the athletes on it, Vanessa Amorosi sang a song called Heroes Live Forever. What a set of pipes that girl has just hearing it. She's an extraordinary singer.
And is it true that the flag ripped, the material ripped a few times into rehearsal?
No, in the rehearsal it actually ripped. It
came apart.
We had, as you always do with any stadium ceremony, you have enormous problems with the press who will go anywhere to get a good shot.
Yep.
And this time they decide, no one knew about the giant flag, the giant piece of sailcloth
that
was going to come down the seat.
Yeah.
So these guys, NBC it was, biggest nightmare you can have because they paid $3 billion for the Olympics and they're going to film it however they want to. And they had hid themselves in the seats at the bottom of that end of the stadium. And as the flag was coming down, they jumped up with their cameras.
They ripped it.
When they're looking at the field. Of course, there was nothing on the field, so they're just standing there like idiots, and they've got their flags up with their antennas. Sorry, the cameras up with their antennas, the sheet comes behind them and just rips.
And you had some seamstress ready?
They actually took it back to the sailcloth people.
Did they?
And they managed to do another one.
Another one.
But overnight.
So it came down from the back of one of the temporary end stands that are no longer there. Mm. And the punters were just...
No punters. This was just rehearsal.
But when the punters were there, how did it work? Were there people... They just mucked in.
They went with the flow.
Yeah, they just mucked in. Well, you would.
Yeah. Terrific.
So for the first time and the last time, Sydney was in sync. We were all in sync.
Yeah.
Parking,
traffic.
Yeah. People were friendly to each other.
I came back from America, leaving a very cynical city, and suddenly found like the whole city was on ecstasy. Everyone's touching me and grabbing me and hugging me. It was like, what's going on in this city?
Queenslanders thought fondly of people from New South Wales and Victoria. It doesn't happen anymore. Briefly.
So, Ignatius, you, we're going through this whole thing. I really did love the, was it called The Awakening? No, The Indigenous.
There was Awakening, yes. Awakening. Yeah. And
Roy Roberts and Stephen Page, beautiful. Yeah. You may have seen the Kathy, the Freeman documentary last weekend.
No?
Yeah.
No, I didn't
you
see
should
it.
Watch could, it because.
I mean, we still don't know where her.
Yes, you do. It was in the papers 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
It was anonymously sent back. Under much shame and guilt, somebody had obviously taken it from the dressing room and stored it for 20 years and just got, they stewed in their own shame.
Is this the speed suit?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. She took it off and then got home and went, oh, where that's gone.
The Awakening was Jacopura Murayaran, who was with Nikki, and they sort of did the journey together, didn't they, through the whole show.
That was the first time that many Indigenous performers from all over the country had ever been brought together. This is a fabulous story about that too. The Central Desert women, of whom there was about 250, had most of them had never worn a shirt in their lives.
Yeah.
Most of them had never seen a car in their lives.
Yeah.
And they were staying out west.
I was about to say, where would you accommodate all these people?
Wherever.
Yeah,
They were staying in a motel out west, and a young guy, Ben Gratz, who was from the Northern Territory, gorgeous young stage manager who was Indigenous but had been adopted by a wealthy white couple and went to NIDA. And,
he was your go-between?
He was their stage manager.
Their stage manager.
He was responsible for getting them from where their motel was out west to the stadium for dress rehearsals, et cetera, et cetera. And on the day of the first dress rehearsal, the buses didn't turn up.
Yeah.
So Ben, being a smart young man, took him on the train.
Perfect.
They'd never seen a drink.
Pretty Opal card too. Would have been complicated.
Hey, now, we're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back for our last section here, talking about the opening of the Sydney Olympics 20 years ago today, 15th of September, here on The Quiet Australian. See you in a minute. And made my heart go boom. The stars were flying.
When the heart goes boom.
Wow. Who was that, Chris?
So that is Olympic gold medalist, dual gold medalist, yeah. Susie O'Neill, Stephen.
And a heart, she's magnificent.
A song called My Heart Goes Boom that went out to her husband.
Aww.
Released it as a single. So a lot of great music came out of the Olympic Games, Sydney Olympic Games, and Susie's single as well. Susie, tremendous athlete, but she will refer to the fact that she won the 200 metres freestyle at Sydney against expectation, but she didn't win the 200 metres butterfly.
Right.
And her nickname, of course, was Madam Butterfly.
Yes.
And she's now on commercial radio in Brisbane. I'm very jealous of her. And
why not do a version of Puccini?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Hello.
Like a posthumous
bit
collab.
Of work,
with,
I know.
Do a posthumous collab with Malcolm McLaren. Come on, it'll be terrific.
Terrific.
Anyway,
did her husband like the song?
I think they're now divorced, but no, they're still together. And so last year on Brisbane commercial radio, she had never seen the race, where she came second in the 200 metres butterfly. Yeah. And they cued it to start her in the studio to watch, dissolved into tears before they even showed her the footage. It still cuts, which is the way elite athletes are. But some of the great music that did come out, Ignatius, was the Tin Symphony. And in the first break of this show, we played a bit of Ian Cooper, who you had an involvement with in getting that music involved.
Yeah,
I
played in a band with Ian called Jadousie after a famous tango in the 1930s. And one night, Ian turned up with a graphite electric violin.
Wow!
Very mean looking, and it was a killer. Mm-hmm. And
was it solid body or empty body? Like,
sorry,
was it solid body?
Solid
or
body.
So it was actually full. It was just no reverb, no nothing. It was just electrics.
It was just electric, but he could make that thing sing. Yeah. You know, I mean, he had it plugged into 14 pedals.
Well, it means also it can go loud if it hasn't got
absolutely.
Reverb chamber. It's not going to feed back.
He was playing it without it being plugged in, you wouldn't
Chris
hear
and
it.
Chris and I finally remember Jean-Luc Ponty, don't we?
Well, I'm more of an Eddie Jobson fan myself, you know, when he replaced Eno in Roxy Music and brought violin to rock and roll in a different way to the Electric Eye Orchestra did it.
That's right.
I kind of like Charlie Daniels, personally.
And sadly, I can remember the name of the violinist in Electric Eye Orchestra.
That is sad.
Mick Kaminsky. But anyway, we move on.
So we're sort of, you know, obviously this is a potted history of that one particular night of the opening, which I think was 4 hours and something.
Yeah, you never know how long it's going to be exactly because of the athletes' parade.
Right, where were you?
I was sitting about as far
nosebleed.
Mm. We were literally in the last row of the temporary
that
seats.
That doesn't sound like status.
Oh. No, they treated the directors like,
jeez, wow, okay.
But what was great was that I was sitting next to Richard Werrett.
Yes,
great
who
Richard
directed
Ware.
The last
segment. Including the cauldron.
He was not alive for not many more years after that, was he?
That's right, he passed away
once
soon
once married
after.
To Jackie Weaver?
That's right.
Indeed. Wow, okay.
And poor old Richard, when that cauldron stopped, was, you know, one of those fabulous scenes where the person next to you sits on your lap and grabs your head and starts to press hard. You know, he was just about to be seen as a director who totally stuffed up in front of 3 billion people.
Why? What happened?
I still think it was over-rehearsed. And everything in the cauldron had backup, you know, everything. If one thing went wrong, then the other one would kick in. And if that went wrong, then the next one would kick in.
Yes, okay.
And that's kind of what happened. It was a 20-cent capacitor.
Okay, so before we go any further, nobody was supposed to know who was carrying the lighting the flame.
Yeah.
As I said, I was in New York, and when it appeared, we just went ballistic, right? So you had, I think it was the centenary of women in Olympics.
Can I talk you through?
Can you please? Yes, yes.
We had the Olympic flag beforehand, yeah. very quickly, Bill Roycroft, equestrian, Murray Rose, swimming, Leanne Tooth, hockey, Gillian Rolton, equestrian, Marjorie Jackson, the Lithgow Flash, track and field.
So there was no rugby league in the Olympics?
Not yet.
Yes, there was.
Lorraine Crapp, swimming, Michael Wendon, swimming, and Mal Meninga, Nick Green, rowing.
Wasn't Dawn Fraser?
No, well, that was the flag.
Oh, yeah, she's an honorary rugby
league. And remember, the flag can never touch the track. It's like, very, very important thing.
And Dawn Fraser stole the flag.
Then
I want to talk about after the event later.
And then Tina Arena and the Sydney Children's Choir sing The Flame, which I'm assuming is the Cheap Trick song, right? No.
And talking about set pipes. Did you see the end when she pointed? Wow.
And so the long relay ends with the great Herb Elliott, the 1500 metre, never beaten at that distance, 1960 Rome Olympics, carries the torch into the stadium.
Yes.
And it is the 100 years of women participating in the Olympics.
Yes. Who got it first?
It was a foursome.
Yeah.
Betty Cuthbert.
Yeah.
Raylene Boyle,
yes.
Dawn Fraser, and Shirley Strickland Delahunty,
right,
which is a huge.
And meanwhile, it's closed. They're being closed in by the participating sports people.
That's right.
They
sort of they form a guard of honor.
It's spotlit, beautiful. Then
so they go in a relay. Yeah. Shane Gould, who's like the first Olympics I remember is 1972. Shane, three golds, a silver, and a bronze. Extraordinary, 15 years old. Trained up where I trained with Forbes Carlisle.
Yes,
one of us went on to Olympic glory.
Pimble.
Right. Swimming Centre.
Okay, right.
Yeah, yeah. And then when she handed it to Debbie Flintoff King, who'd won the 400 metres hurdles in Seoul in '88, and she did the peace sign with her hands, the bird. And then of course Flintoff King hands it over to Cathy Freeman.
Yes, yes.
And there's actually an article in the paper today about John Coates talking about his reasons for selecting Cathy and how emotional he was meeting her. And she just goes, "It's a great honour. Why me?"
Yeah.
And she goes, "I'm happy to do
and
it."
And then she said she eats up pressure.
It's not pressure.
Give me pressure. I'll do it. Because she had not just the 400, the 200, and this particular moment as well to handle.
Well, I mean, I argue, like, it's an off-made argument. And the documentary is extraordinary watching. I watched it last night, and I'm blubbing my way the whole through. Yeah. I mean, I think she's just one of the most unbelievable Australians we've ever had.
Yes, yes.
But an incredible athlete who always maximised her ability at whatever level she could perform, she performed.
And then there was the drama with the French woman. But we'll get to that later.
Marie Jose. But I would wonder now, 20 years on, with the way that professionalism has incurred on sport even more, that she wouldn't have been allowed to do it. Right, because there were a lot of stairs. She was
OH&S.
Yeah, she was in the middle of, and with the delay in the cauldron, she did get wet and cold and whatever. And she had this singular event coming up in her life in about 10 days' time.
But tell us about the glitch.
Yeah.
So she runs up she walks up the stairs, gets to the top, walks lights across it. Water, lights steps it. In the middle, and then the.
Well, it actually goes up.
Right.
It does go up for about... It does go up for about...
That's right. So it's gone above and it's firing above and then it has to sit there.
Well, it's meant to go straight up.
Right.
Right. And as it comes up, the trunk gets inside it and lifts it up.
Yes.
And the big issue we had was that as it was going up, it was on gas tanks.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And... when it gets to the top,
goes to mains.
The trunk gets it, and the mains are in the trunk.
Right, right. Okay.
So one of we had two big worries, and only one is really talked about, which is the fact that we were going to run out of gas.
Yes.
If the thing did not
too long.
Keep going, and that was the hassle. It was a 20-cent capacitor.
That's what you're saying about Richard Ware, etc. That you don't want to be the games where the flame goes out before it starts.
Well, exactly, and built into that was the fact that Richard had really fought for the music he was using, which was Berlioz's Requiem, and there was a lot of hoo-ha about
that. Can I say that was the one thing that really grated when I saw the replay? I thought, where are we at a high Anglican funeral?
Well,
it just really struck me as odd, you know.
I had issues with it. I was in charge of the crackers because I'd been in charge of cracking, you know, me and crackers.
Oh, we missed cracking on. And
obviously, the crackers were going to go off after the cauldron.
Yeah.
That was not Sid Howard?
No, it was Fotis.
It was Fotis then.
Yeah,
wow,
it was Fotis. And I'm very close to Fotis.
Yeah.
They had said to me, look, give us some music, you know, because it's really hard. It's a different vibe to do crackers without music and crackers with music. And you know, my other thing was I didn't want Sydney's Australia's Olympics to finish with a Frenchman's funeral.
Yeah.
So I just happened to find I've been working with the Sydney Symphony, and I realised that they played a piece by Percy
Grainger,
okay. Called "The Warriors," which they didn't do that often because it takes two whole orchestras to do it. But we had a recording of it, and we had the sheet music, and you know they weren't going to play it live. You know the orchestra's half bow in because you can't amplify them. You get wind into them in the microphones. Anyway, so we fortunately, just as the music runs out, and if you watch it, and the cauldron is sitting there, and just as it starts moving again, in comes Percy Grainger and the firework.
Can you imagine Percy arriving and going, "I've got something for you guys, two orchestras, please." And you were at work, Dennis, right?
You still didn't know whether the gas was going to hold out.
No, we did. Once it got the trunk in.
This is just like the Apollo 11 lunar module landing. Yes. 19 seconds of fuel.
19 seconds of fuel.
You were at work.
Were
you watching it live?
I was in my studio in Glebe watching. Oh, no. I'd gone home from work because my other half was pregnant, 7.5 months pregnant, and she'd been hosting the prelude.
Can we say who it is?
Chris Barth. So she was pregnant with Darcy. So my son was on the stage.
Oh, right.
In her belly.
That's fantastic.
And she, because of, you know, being 7.5 months pregnant, she actually came home after the prelude and missed the first hour of the ceremony, and I watched the rest with her. And we were sitting on the couch and she was going, No.
Being there as you and I both were, you know, like, you always remember those things as you're thinking that it just took forever before it actually got going and they had to override the switch. And
didn't someone hit it with a stick?
Literally. Yeah. Well, that's the rumor.
Exactly what happened.
I mean, but it took 4 minutes, right? And we were talking the other day about
Percussive maintenance.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, we've been talking a bit about moon missions lately. Apollo 12 gets hit by lightning. Within 30 seconds, they work out, flick the switch. It takes us 4 minutes. But my memory actually, because everybody was going, oh, no. But it actually didn't seem that long as 4 minutes. Because you were just willing it to be over. So it actually was. It was kind of the weird reverse. But if it didn't work, that's it for Samaranch. There's no greatest games, anything. It's just taken it away from him.
Yeah.
But it was quite a moment. And then if you go on and watch the Freeman documentary,
if that wasn't enough for Kathy Freeman, we had something else to come. But the crackers were going off. Once you'd wrapped up and you got out of the precinct, what did you do, Ignatius?
Straight to the pub.
Do you remember the drink?
Well, at Homebush?
At Homebush.
Yeah.
With the crowds.
You could always, because, you know, it's sort of wrap around about 11, 12 at night. You could always see some of the athletes in there.
I think we were skipping from Soho to Greenwich, going, "We're Aussies, woohoo!"
Well, we had, there was eight bombs in the stadium.
Yeah.
And if someone wasn't in their bomb when they should be, the stage managers had been rehearsed to say, "He's in bomb 9. Which was, of course, the Homebush pub. Yes.
Now, one last thing. Dean Perry, of course, Tap Dogs, et cetera, was involved with one of the segments. He also does show calls for the Rugby League during the final series as a second sort of standby. Lovely man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who was doing the show call on the night of the Olympics? Do you remember?
Lovely lady called Dawn Martin and a lovely man called Adam Lowe.
Two of them. Why two?
Redundancy, in case one fell over.
Yeah,
well,
one got stuck on the ramp. Yeah. one was in Vom 9.
He was in Vom 9 pretty soon.
But you had a bit of flexibility, as you said, a bit of time could move. The segments were all recorded, each one.
They backed each other up.
Right, okay.
They backed each other up. Yeah. And funnily enough, Adam was the producer on Vivid for the last 2 years.
Ah, yes.
So he's still in the business.
Yes, you've heard of Vivid?
Hey?
You've heard of Vivid?
Yes. Well, this man here picked me up, put me into Vivid, and that was six years ago this year, but you were there another 5 or 6, 7 years before that, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there for 10 long years.
Stephen, Dennis, can I say, because I think we're heading towards the end of this particular show.
Story.
And the Rugby League season's going to wrap fairly soon, and we're going to keep going with this show. Surely we can get Ignatius back to talk about his solo music career, Vivid, all those sorts of things. There's so many wonderful things. Yeah. Very quickly, did you have an involvement in the closing ceremony?
Yes.
I always feel the closing ceremony doesn't get the props it deserves. I thought it was an extraordinary night.
It's always the poor relation.
But it got a higher audience, 1.4 billion, I think, 1.2 for the opening.
It's also why it's always pop music.
Yes, of course.
So all the bands.
Kylie Minogue doing Dancing Queen.
That's a party.
The Oils. The Oils. That was an amazing moment.
And I was at that one.
There you go.
I was at that one. Finally. It was so much better.
Yes. Yeah. Red Bombast, of course, the inflatables.
And
The drag queens.
I'm trying to remember.
Oh, and our friend Tobin Saunders, I just saw a picture the other day. Indeed. Was sitting in one of them.
and it starts, is it Stephen? I can't remember. He was on the lawnmower or whatever it was, right at the start.
One of the trio string backups.
Yeah, so there's a solo thing, and it's whatever he's trying to start is not working.
Lawnmower Man.
And all the people around me are going, I can't believe it. We made it all the way through, and now this guy is stuffing up. It was perfect. Everyone was just sucked in.
Yeah. Wonderful. In excess, who else? Did Jimmy Barnes get to do anything?
Yep. He did Working Class Man.
Kylie. The Oils, not bad, eh?
Painters and Dockers played, I think, from memory. Am I right on that? Lubricated Goat? No, am I getting this wrong?
But no AC/DC.
The Roar.
No AC/DC.
That's weird. Why?
They asked for too much money.
Did they?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody else played for, this is Olympic tradition, one gold dollar.
Wow. Beautiful.
But AC/DC wanted a.
Because I've always heard they won't mind. They'll only ever perform live to start with, which is why they've never done the NRL, though Cole Chisel changed that, of course.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that gold coin legal tender? Could you use it?
Or a doubloon, a 12th century doubloon.
And to top it off, you and I both saw Cathy Freeman run.
Yes.
I was getting a coffee. There was only one espresso machine in the whole state.
No, don't say this.
I was in a queue of about 40. I got to the front, paid for coffee for me and my dad, who's no longer with us, but a great athletics fan. And then everybody ran. No coffee. They just ran. I went, so I raced back, not knowing what time it was going to be. He said, no, you're okay. It's just about to happen. And I swear, 109,000 people crying. They were all in tears.
For me, there are three nights of sport that define me. One was winning our Northern Suburbs Premier League Basketball Championship after chasing it for 30 years, and I thought I'd never do it. The second is the Tigers winning in 2005, having been there in 89 when Balmain lost to your Canberra Raiders.
Did you cry?
No. I was emotional when I rang my mother. I was emotional when I rang my mother.
2005.
But yeah,
you're emotional.
Yeah, but that night is the greatest night of sport I've ever been involved in. It started with Tatiana Grigorieva going up against Stacey Dragila in the pole vault. So they got the Australians going.
Yeah.
For the nerds, you know, there was...
We loved her as a new Aussie, didn't we?
There was the Romanian Szabo beating Sonia O'Sullivan in the women's 5,000 metres.
Yeah, yeah.
Does anyone remember that Michael Johnson ran in the men's 400 metres?
No.
The greatest male sprinter of all time. No one remembers. And
there was a long jump too, wasn't there?
The triple jump. Jonathan Edwards, the world record for the Great Britain.
Yeah.
Maria Mottola won the 800 metres for Mozambique on the track. Yeah. And then the final event of the night, was the men's 10,000 metres, which is pretty much my favourite race.
Yeah.
And the Ethiopian Haile Gebrselassie was the unbackable favourite. Right. And the way the 10,000 metre worked, it's not like the Tour de France. You don't get a breakaway pack going away. It's just you set a pace. And it's a war of attrition, and people drop off.
Yeah.
So we're into the final lap, and Gebrselassie's up against the two Kenyans who are running together.
Oh,
and I did write their names down.
As a pack.
Paul Turgat and Asifa Mezgebu, right?
Yeah.
Now, Gebrselassie, best sprint. 100 metres out, if you're all level 100 metres, it's a gold medal. It's done.
Yeah.
So they have to make a move from further out. And
that's
I was on the back straight, right? And so Gebrselassie's sitting there, rails run, looking great. He's got the two Kenyans on the right shoulder.
Yeah.
And he just momentarily looks left to see if there's any other threat. So he looks left and the two Kenyans have gone.
They go.
And you see Gebrselassie go, holy Michael Luck. And he chases them and he gets them on the line.
Oh, yeah,
it was extraordinary. Yeah. The stadium was way less than half full.
Of course.
Everyone had gone because Cathy had won.
Yeah.
The two Kenyans went and did victory lap, high fives. It was an extraordinary night. But the Freeman thing, you know, as they say in the documentary, Cathy ran a race plan according to a coach to win the gold medal, not to do her best time.
Best time, no. She did 49, right?
Yeah. So her reaction, first of all, just looked like, oh, I'm glad that's over, and disappointed about the time.
I didn't do 48 or under.
Yeah. and even McAvaney's call, when it's just like the definitive record of the call.
Work to do.
And that's the moment. Like, I think even he says it's probably not, it's his definitive call, but he just goes, Cathy has work to do.
Oh, yep.
and she was like, and she was in third on the, and it just encapsulated exactly that moment.
Well,
it was
you're in, you're on the straight, the home straight.
I was on the back straight.
So
she's about 250
coming
meters
coming around
to go.
The corner. You couldn't tell.
Yeah.
You thought, oh no, she's blown it.
No, she was just sitting, and she describes in the documentary, I felt incredible the whole night, and she goes, I was jogging in the back because she was going to kick from 120 meters out.
Yep.
And she was the athlete under the most pressure. Yeah, and Marie
and the suit.
And the suit. Yeah. And she said it was like slicing through air. And Marie-Josée Parekh, who was an amazing
athlete.
Runner. But she pouted, let's face it.
She did a Sonny Bill Williams.
She did a Sonny Bill Williams. She went to France in disgrace.
I've got one more question before we wrap it up. The eternity sign.
Mm.
Tell us about that.
Gosh, the eternity sign was something that took quite a while to work up.
You mean to convince people? No.
Yes.
Yes.
To convince people.
Yeah.
We actually, after we'd done the first Bridge Effect in 1996-7, which was actually our designer, Peter England, having a funny cigarette while sitting at the at the Opera House and looking at the bridge and going, I am smiling. And so, up it went.
Wow.
We then had to think about, bridge effects for the next few years. Yeah. And I had all of these Martin Sharp prints.
Of course, he was a big fan.
Of course, he was.
I'm a huge fan of his work.
Yeah.
In my office at the
Was there
just on the
just
wall
looking at you.
Yeah, and we had this. But funnily enough, we had this work experience guy. I don't know where he was from, some posh school. And the biggest problem with work experience people is getting them.
They're bored, right?
Yeah. Well, giving them something to do. Anyway, he became infatuated with eternity, and
he didn't know the history.
Didn't know the history.
No.
And I just happened to have the old video, the VCR documentary on Arthur Stace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, if you're interested, take it home and
read up.
Yeah, read up on it. Anyway, that Friday afternoon when we had our usual 1 o'clock, which is...
What time that start?
When we always got our best ideas.
Afternoon is 12:01 p.m.
Yeah, that's And we were going, what are we going to do? And this little kid goes, why don't you put eternity up on the bridge?
It's amazing.
Really true. And I went,
who has no name?
Hold that thought. I've forgotten it.
And now he's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, right? Yeah. Who would have thought?
Can he contact us, Chris? Is there a point?
Please.
Right. And then did officially you blow up the rings on the bridge?
We did. And that was always the idea. Yeah. So the OCA, the Olympic Coordination Authority, and I used to remind people that ochre was Latin for goose. they were desperate to put the rings up on the bridge.
Yes.
And went and did it without us. We were doing the fireworks for the city of Sydney, and they said, no, we'll do it. So they spent about 12 times more money than we would have spent.
Put the rings up, yeah.
Yeah, putting these actual rings up. Yeah. What we used to do was put up a mesh and sew rope light onto it.
Yes.
So, it was wind transparent, light. Yeah. It was light, it could be, But no, they had to. So we went, okay, well, can we put fireworks on them? And they said, no, you'll blow them up, you'll do it. We said, nah. Anyway, we did all the mathematics, and we figured out that the reverse force was not going to do anything too serious. So, at the last moment of the fireworks, which again I was in charge of, that's what
Forge.
I did in
30?
Forge.
Yeah, okay,
Forge. What I did in closing ceremony was the crackers, and we actually until. They opened Atlantis in Dubai about 10 years later. It was still the biggest fireworks show in history.
Wow. And they used some of Pee Wee's music in the crackers, didn't they, I think? From
We did. Yeah. We did. Yeah. Yeah. We used the Olympic, we used Arrivals.
Arrivals, right, okay.
Can I just say I'm wearing my official Sydney Bid T-shirt from Monaco 1993.
Wow.
And you're holding your breasts.
Yeah. Well, I still fit in it, courtesy of my friend Shauna Wilson.
Can I just give you a little tidbit too, talking about the Bid? I was called in by the manager of Rogues, the nightclub, on a quiet night. It was shut down and there was going to be, well, it was actually an afternoon, late lunch dinner. It was being held by Gretel Packer. A bunch of ladies only to basically smother Prince Albert with attention because he was one of the, what do they call
judges. Delegates.
Yep. We wanted his vote. So it was one of those many things they did to get it over the line. There must have been many of those. I saw him at the Cauldron a few days later.
And what, you were providing the musical accompaniment?
I
provided
the background music, yeah.
What's Prince Albert into? He'd be a Sade guy, wouldn't he?
Yes. Smooth operator.
Yes.
I'll say no more. Now, on that note, that's it. Fire up the Quiet Australian. Thank you very much, Ignatius Jones.
Oh, thank you, Ignatius. That was wonderful.
Dennis, Chris, myself. See ya.